You're listening to the Inspire Excellence Podcast, recorded at the BVA headquarters with your hosts, Kevin Miller and Tommy Alquist. Each episode is focused on shedding new light on different perspectives to create dialogue that inspires excellence.
And welcome once again to the Inspire Excellence Podcast. Tommy Alquist, Kevin Miller, hoping to inspire you. Tommy, how are you?
I'm doing great, Kevin.
You know, it's such a balance between business and politics. You know, how do you really, the president and others, they try and balance that out. It's, you've been there. How do you balance that?
It's like bad memories you're bringing up at the start of the story?
No. But I mean, people say if we could apply the business principles.
So that's why today's really exciting for us. When we made our master list of guests we want to have on this show, Inspire Excellence wanted to talk to people that have done both, and very few people in our state have done both. So our guest today has balanced and done both. So we're going to be talking to Jeff Sayre. So a little background on Jeff, longtime business leader, and we'll get into that. Very, very successful businessman who then became the director of commerce for the state of Idaho and did a phenomenal job in that role. Now back to business and doing a lot of business development and turnarounds, and we'll get into that with him. But it's going to be fun today to talk about that, because I do think in the world, a lot of us that see the business world, it's very much based on pro formas and strategy and business plans
returns
and work ethic. And then you do see the other side of government, and sometimes you scratch your head. Now, a lot of good people in government. There's a lot of great elected officials that are doing a wonderful job. But very few people that have seen both sides of that equation. And so we're excited to have you here today. Jeff Sayre.
Well, I'm honored, gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Jeff, which do you prefer, the private sector or the public sector?
That's easy, private sector. I lasted as long as I possibly could in the public sector. But you know what? I wouldn't trade it for anything, though. A lot of people kind of, you know, teased me a little bit about becoming a government guy. And I didn't want to put a tie back on when I first got asked to take the position, but I loved it. I mean, I got a chance to recruit and work with some of the best teams I've ever had in my career. And I got a chance to see how things really work on the inside. And, you know, you guys are kind of joking about business and politics, but I firmly believe it's like Governor Otter used to say, you can always bring business principles to state government. And we saw how that works. But no, to answer your question, I'm glad to be back in the private sector.
Hey, Jeff, before we get rolling, you've done a lot in your career. I mean, you've got a great background. Highly, highly respected by anyone who knows you, who's worked with you.
Very generous.
Can you give us a little background on just your upbringing, and then more importantly, what inspired you to go into business? What kind of principles did you learn from your mentors growing up? And tell us a little bit about your business background.
No, I'd be glad to. So I'm an Idaho kid. Started in Blackfoot, but my fam we got moved to Wisconsin of all places. I grew up in junior high and high school in Wisconsin. We've all since migrated back to Idaho, but I started my career with Ernst & Young in Silicon Valley, and it's the late 80s. And we had an amazing time. Our office there had probably 60 to 70% of the high tech market were all our clients. So anybody who was a who of that, that industry back then were all our clients. And so as a young professional, I got a chance to participate in public offerings and venture capital financings, in watching how you scale and grow companies. I mean, I saw the whole spectrum. It was just amazing. But trying to raise a family in Silicon Valley on public accounting wages just was not a smart financial formula.
So what did your dad do? Tell me a little bit. I've never asked this. I don't know.
My dad was a 30-year veteran with Basic American Foods.
Okay.
He was an engineer by trade, spent some time out at the Idaho National Lab, but ended his career as one of the top middle management people inside of Basic American. And, you know, you talk about my dad, and we've all of our siblings have all come back and realized that, you know, my dad provided us a great foundation, great opportunities. He was the first one in his family to go to college. So he kind of broke the mold, and he encouraged us all to...
Where was he from?
He's from the Lost River Valley. So a little town called Leslie used to have a post office, and they no longer have a post office. So it was, you know, they had a family farm there for a number of years, and my siblings and I would all go back and work on the family farm in the summers. And I've often joked that I moved enough hand lines on the farm during the summer to stay in college.
What was your mom like, Jeff?
You know, my mom was an angel. She was a stay-at-home mom our entire lives, and she's the one that taught us how to care for people and taught us what love really means. And, you know, some of us have come back and realized as we've grown older in our lives just how special of a woman she is and the example she gave us. But my dad was, like I said, he broke the mold for his family, and he was one of the professionals, one of the few professionals within his sibling group, and he opened up doors for us and gave us a great start. You know,
greatest lesson he taught you. How to work.
How to work. Oh man, So my brother and I were the two oldest, and we lived in Wisconsin on an acre and a quarter, and we got to dig trenches through heavily wooded areas to put in sprinkler systems that, you know, fulfilled my dad's dream of having automatic sprinklers back then. And so, yeah, he was always putting chores in front of us and making sure we delivered results. And it's, looking back, that's one of the most priceless lessons that we've all appreciated. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to kind of wrap up that, your question, one of the funnest, most meaningful experiences I had was when I had a chance to serve as the president CFO of Mountain View Hospital. So I was living in the Idaho Falls area for quite a while. And we were forming a committee actually to be one of the early supporters of the Meth Project. And we'd formed a group of community advisors to come in and help us. And Carol Honus was there. And if, you know, Carol's one of the most public faces in Eastern Idaho. She's an amazing person. And I walked downstairs to join the meeting, and she saw me come in. I sat down kind of on the side, and she leaned back in her chair and she said, "Are you Lauren Sayer's son?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "I love that man." And she went on to just praise him and who he was and the type of person he is. And in that moment, I realized that he's given us a legacy. And I, with my siblings, we all realize that if there's anything we do, it's to protect his legacy and try to be honorable people so that we never let him down. Mm. And, you know, he was a quiet, you know, person. He did a great job professionally, but anyway, he gave us an example. Sorry, I didn't mean to go off on that long tangent, but
no, I love it.
You struck a chord there, and I love it.
Sorry to interrupt you. You were in Silicon Valley, but I thought, wait, we got to get back.
No.
I love hearing the part of you that you know, there's something that built and trained and mentored Jeff Sayer. So I wanted to not skip that.
Well, moving around like we did, we learned that we can start from anywhere, and change doesn't scare me. Meeting new people doesn't scare me. I mean, I enjoy those kinds of things. And as I think back on my life, I think all of that has kind of culminated in who I've become today. But yeah, I think back fondly of my growing up years, and we weren't wealthy. We didn't have a lot of great things, but you know, my mom and dad provided for us, and they're just amazing people, and they set the standard for us.
That's great.
Anyway, so I you know, grew up in Idaho, spent time in Wisconsin, came back, and went to BYU, went on the LDS mission, and then came back to BYU, finished my degree in accounting, started my career at Ernst & Young in Silicon Valley, and I fell in love with corporate finance back then. And it was kind of interesting. I didn't really know a whole lot about where I knew I wanted to be in business. I actually started in chemical engineering. I liked the technical science. And those kinds of things. And I hit a lab class in chemistry. I think it was my sophomore year when I got back from my mission, and I was trying to get back into the engineering classes. And I was in a lab class where it was just kicking my tail. I was not coming out of it successfully. And I had kind of aligned myself with a group of smart people, and I was kind of piggybacking on their capabilities to get through this class. And I remember sitting in a hallway, we were standing there on a Friday night, and we had just finished this extensive lab assignment. And there was a kid there who was really smart, but he had a t-shirt on where he had all the scientific formulas. And he was bragging to us how he could tell his dates what every one of those formulas meant. And I thought in that moment, you know what? I don't really want to hang out with people like you the rest of my life.
That is a great story.
I think I'm going to find something else. And that's when I started looking at business. And I had a really good friend say, you know, if you go into business, go into accounting because it's the language of business. And I thought that makes sense. So I got into the BYU accounting program and I've never looked back.
That's great.
Anyway, nothing against scientists or, you know, people who understand all those formulas because I have a lot of respect for them. But in that moment, I realized, okay, this is probably not the field I want to stay in. And that's what got me into business. And I love it. And I've been in, you know, corporate finance most of my career. And as you alluded to before, I've seen companies at scale. I've seen what it takes to grow a company, seen what it takes to finance a company. And unexpectedly got pulled in about midway through my career into some challenging situations and found out I like turnarounds, that I'm not afraid of a messy situation, and was fairly successful with a couple turnarounds. And the most notable one for me was over in Eastern Idaho with Mountain View Hospital. I had a good buddy of mine call and say, hey, I just wrote out a big check for a little hospital in Idaho and I think it's in trouble. I need you to go look at it. And I thought, well, I don't know anything about healthcare. Isn't there somebody else you'd rather call? And he said, no, he said, you're from there. You understand the culture. He said, you know, and you know business, just get up there and help me with it. And I did. And what I thought was going to be a 6-month consulting project turned into a 6-year commitment. Mm-hmm. And I fell in love with the facility, the community, what it stood for, what they're trying to accomplish. And we took what was at the time a tiny 20-bed hospital into what's now, I think, the 4th or 5th largest healthcare system in the state. Hmm. And that was notable enough and visible enough that it was shortly after that the governor's team reached out to me and said, hey, would you ever consider coming over and helping us turn our commerce department around? And that's...
Hey, before we jump to that, for those people listening that may be small business owners, with your experience,
yeah,
what are the few mistakes that you've seen made over the years by companies that you would advise people to watch for or look for?
Oh man, that's a great question. We could take an hour on. you know, the thing that catches people a lot is they don't fully respect or understand the significance of really executing a strategy. A lot of people kind of gloss over the value of their operations. And they just assume that because they have a department or a team or they have a function that everything's working and they can set a strategy and just go after it. But truly successful business people, they break down their operations and they manage them at the deepest level possible. And they're constantly improving. Hmm. I mean, people take their eye off cash flows. They take their eye off the accounting. They take their eye off margins. A lot of times people take their eye off the quality of their teams and making sure you have the right talent, you know, aligned with the highest priorities. I mean, there's just, you know, from being in business, there's a lot of different aspects to making a business run successfully. But I think that at the end of the day, it's those people that really know how to execute a strategy and operate a business and pay attention to the details. Those are the ones that come through in the end.
That's great. Kevin, I've talked too much.
No, I, you know, Jeff, you've set us up. So, you know, here we are, the Gem State today. Everything is booming. People want to come here. But in your time, you were like a college recruiter. You were out hitting the trail.
Yeah, that's a great way to say it.
Right. And bringing people here. For people that remember that, or maybe they think that was always good times in the state of Idaho, could you take us back to your time in commerce?
You know, I'm happy to, and I'll just maybe plant a seed if we have enough time, that I still have some grave concerns about where we're headed and what we're not paying attention to right now. But that's, you know, we can...
Tommy's going to ask a follow-up on that.
That's you guys' call if you want to come back to that. But, you know, the thing that was fun for me was coming into government with a business perspective. Because I started asking some of the fundamental questions of what are we really in this for? What are we trying to accomplish? And what was really interesting is I brought a business question to the forefront that is really simple, and that is, who's our customer? And it was really interesting to stand in front of this team at Commerce and ask that question. And we had about a 6-month debate about who our customer is. Hmm. And we finally got back to the fact that our customers at the time, well, not at the time, but our customers are businesses, our Idaho businesses. And what was really interesting is part of the challenge I was hired into. So I was asked to kind of revitalize the department. It had turned inward. and wasn't really paying attention to what was happening outside. And so we had this conversation about who we're really serving. And we finally got to the point where people are recognizing, oh, we actually need to care about what our Idaho businesses are experiencing. And so we fixed that. You know, when I got recruited, there's a number of business people that said at the time that commerce had become either irrelevant or non-existent to them. And I just thought, that's a travesty. That's just wrong. In a little state that has so much potential, we have to fix this. So we fixed it. And what was fun is we got the team looking outward, and then we recruited a number of highly intelligent people from business into the team, started reshaping the focus, reshaping the pace and the cadence and the direction. And what was fun is we got back in front of the communities. We got back in front of business. And we started asking them, what is it you need? What can we do to help? How can we be that resource for you? And it was energizing for me as a director and for the team just to kind of re-engage in those conversations. That's one of the things we did. But one of the things that we found as we started asking those questions is we also asked a question of, how are we competitive and where are we not competitive as a state? And that's when we started getting feedback from a lot of people in the economic development world that we lack tools, for our communities to be competitive and for our state to be competitive in recruiting. And that's why you saw us go out and set up a lot of incentive tools. So we put a closing fund in place. It's called the Opportunity Fund. But the tool that got the most attention was the tax reimbursement incentive. And, you know, it has its opponents, and not everyone's completely happy about it, but it's been really effective.
But isn't that the cost of doing business, these incentives that are both smart for the business and smart for the state? You look at the southern states with the automobile plants. That's a really great private partner, public partnership. Tommy, you're going to have to...
Public-private partnership.
Yeah, Tommy. You have to practice that one.
Yeah.
You know, but what we found, Kevin, to your point, is what we were hearing is we weren't even making the list. So as site selectors and as companies would look at what state they wanted to expand into, we weren't even making the cut because they had a checklist, and one of those items on the checklist was a tax incentive. And what you find out when you get in that world is it's a business too. And companies are looking for the best packages they can get. And one of the items on that checklist is a tax incentive. And when we didn't have it, we weren't even making the cut. So we weren't seeing a lot of projects. So that's one of the motivations we had to go out and get that set up so that the state as a whole could be competitive. But we worked on some incentives. We worked on, you know, revitalizing and reshaping the team, getting them refocused. And what's really fun for me is to watch now some of the successes that team continues to have. There's some really smart people over there. And I've told them, and I firmly believe they were one of the best teams I've ever worked with in my entire career. And it was a special time for me.
Let me ask you a couple of questions in your time there. Jeff, your approach was refreshing. Your leadership was refreshing. We watched from the outside as you kind of shaped that department, and it made a huge impact on our state, especially in a time where we were recovering from a recession.
Yeah.
We needed it badly. It was fun to watch. But I also think you uncovered some formulas for government that hopefully they follow, right? Meaning, I remember to the moment, the first time I saw you kind of just whiteboard out in my office, hey, we need talent.
Yeah.
We need to fuel that talent. The talent is our kids. And we need to figure out a way to match our kids in Idaho to Idaho jobs. And there is a role for government. For heaven's sakes, it's government dollars being spent, our tax dollars. Let's put them to work where we have a return on our investment. And for me to be sitting there and listening to a government guy now, I know you weren't a government guy, talk about ROI.
Yeah.
Oh, it's refreshing. And so tell us, for our listeners here, what you learned about talent pipelines, the important role of governments and universities. And I think you probably could, we could talk about this for hours today, but there was a lot you learned and then you left as a legacy behind for the Department of Commerce and for Idaho State Government that I think they're still using a lot of those really key lessons that you taught while there.
No, I appreciate the question. So, you know, someone asked me when I left, they asked me a really interesting question. They said, can you put in one sentence what Idaho needs to be successful. I thought about it for a second and I said, you know what? I can do it in two words, talent and capital. And, you know, I remember those whiteboard conversations we had in your office. And we were, so Director Ken Edmonds and I, who we've both since left state government, he and I were working on a number of different strategies. We were copying other states to try and figure out what the proper role of government is in that formula. Back to your point, because there is a role. And I think that to answer your question, one of the lessons I did learn is that, you know, we want to keep government limited because we don't want to overspend. I mean, that's just smart at any level. But at some point, there is a role government can play. And the talent issue is really important. And Kevin, this kind of goes back to what I was alluding to. One of the concerns I have when it comes to talent is I worry we're getting comfortable and we're deluding ourselves just a little bit because we're spending in education and we're developing this sense that if we just invest in education, it's automatically going to fix our talent problems. And that scares me to death because that's not even close. We do need to invest in education, but it's foundational. It's not tactical. And this is where I would, to answer your question, Tom, I would say that one of the things I did learn is that government, if they want to be, can be tactical. And one of the classic stories that I've been telling people to try to kind of draw attention to this is we desperately need talent pipelines. And a talent pipeline is a specific tactical investment in a known need in the economy. We have a handful that are, we just know their needs that we have right now and we're going to need in the future. So my argument is we should be making tactical investments in those needs. One of the things we talk about as a state is how we want to have high paying jobs and have jobs our kids can come home to or stay in Idaho to enjoy. And so another business principle you'd apply is, okay, then we need to start paying attention to where the world is going so we can have those jobs, right? Well, computer science, for example, is one of those classic industry sectors that we know is going to be part of our future for several years. A great example of a government strategy is what Utah's done in developing their talent pipelines in computer science. And I tell a story about how I had a chance to go down to Utah over Christmas holiday, and I got introduced, friend of a friend, to a gentleman who's a leader in the tech environment in their industry down there, and he's also a legislator. And it was shortly after I left Commerce, so it was fascinating to swap notes. And we got talking back and forth about economic development strategies. And you shared with me that Utah's tech sector, this is 2 years ago, is growing at 7% a year. And I remind people when I tell this story that China consumed the entire globe's commodities at 8% a year, right? So just to calibrate. So Utah's tech sector is growing at 7% a year. And I probably shouldn't tell this part of the story, but I said, you know, one of the unfortunate parts about Idaho, I said, is we have a number of state leaders in Boise that are convinced that the reason you guys are having that kind of growth is because you have lower taxes. And he laughed. And he said, no, he said, that helps. He said, but let me tell you some of the things we've done. And he told me a story that it won't leave me. He said, a few years ago, we invested $20 million into a fund that was dedicated to rewarding higher education institutions for producing computer science graduates. And I haven't had a chance to study the chapter and verse on how they did it, but essentially it was a performance-based, outcomes-based funding mechanism where these universities got rewarded for producing that degree. So again, it's a known need in their economy, right? He said, we had universities step up and create a program where they didn't have one, and many expanded their program to access that capital. And here's what stopped me in my tracks. They have 4,000 students in their computer science talent pipeline in Utah. Hmm. 4,000. If you think about that for a second. So I checked, just so I'm somewhat accurate, we have about 600 statewide. So you ask me what we need to be doing, that's where I get worried that we're complacent in this idea that if we just keep investing in education, everything's going to be fine. Even if it was, that's a 20-year play. We're not going to see results in that for 20 years. But if we adopted some tactical things like that, what Utah did, it'd be really easy to set up a much smaller fund that could fuel the growth in our computer science arena. And if you're okay, let me, I'll finish the story.
Oh, yeah.
So here's what's really fascinating about this. So again, if you apply business perspectives to government, right now we're sitting in a fascinating time where the big tech centers on the West Coast, Seattle, Silicon Valley, little Portland to some extent, are all struggling. There's a ton of talent there, but they're all struggling because it's such a high cost of living. And those employees don't have the quality of life they could have somewhere else. So those tech companies, a lot of them are looking for lower cost communities to expand into, not to move into, but just to expand into. But they have to know that there's a talent pipeline they can rely on to grow, right? That's the one thing that limits them from going to an area. Well, you look in particular the Treasure Valley. We have everything you'd want from a quality of life standpoint, family values. The whole list is right here. And not just in Treasure Valley, but in all of Idaho. So the other story I tell people is I had a chance to sit down with the head of the computer science department at Boise State about the time we had helped him get funding. They'd gone from 25 graduates to 50, and they would just help them get funding to go from 50 to 100. And we were kind of high-fiving, and we were talking about it. And then he started telling me about the phone calls he was receiving from the Bay Area about tech companies who were asking about Boise. I'm like, wait a minute, why are you getting the calls and not me? I'm the Commerce Department, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking, what's wrong with this picture? And then he explained to me what they're asking, and it all made sense. They had one question. How many graduates do you have? And he explained that they're, you know, the momentum, 25 to 50, 50 to 100. I think they're now a little about around 130 or so. But a majority of them had one, they all congratulated him on the momentum, but they had one statement they made. They said, let us know when you get to 200, because that's the moment when we'll be interested. So I, of course, asked him, how much would it take to get to 200 graduates? And you can't hold me or him, you know, accountable to this number because it's back of the napkin and kind of his top of mind. But he said, $3 to $4 million. That's a rounding error in our state government budgets. And if you think about business tactics, so you got all those market dynamics where you've got those coastal cities looking for lower cost overflow locations to expand into, right? And yet we have everything to offer, but we don't have a talent pipeline. But imagine what happened if we had 200 graduates coming out of Boise State. This growth curve, a lot of people don't want to hear this, but if we were able to accomplish that and somehow get them to 200 graduates, the growth that we're experiencing now would last another 10 years with high quality, high paying jobs that would bring our kids back home. Those are the things that I get pretty animated about having left Commerce, because I see, going back to your question, Tommy, I see a chance to be tactical. And I worry because we're talking about these broad theoretical, sometimes, you know, 30,000 foot strategies. And some of those are important. But at some level, we really ought to get down in the weeds and get tactical about how we're spending the money and things that we're doing that could make a huge difference.
Sorry, I didn't mean to
I'm just sitting here listening to you thinking it is that tactical approach that you've got money you're spending.
Yeah.
You know the needs on the other end. You know our weaknesses or our blind spots. Be tactical in how you implement your strategy.
Well, especially when you know the opportunities that could come with a nominal amount of investment.
Well, it's refreshing to hear. Kevin, I'll keep talking unless you do.
One thing that I think our listeners would really like to know is what was it like to work with former Governor Otter, who's been involved in politics since 72, self-made guy, but an equally astute businessman who, you know, he's comfortable wherever he is. He has that charisma.
Yeah.
That, even if you don't like him, you can't help but give him a hug.
He's a good man.
What was it like to work with him?
No, I appreciate you asking that question. You know, it was actually a highlight of my career. And I've told this story a little bit. When I sat down and we shook hands on my appointment, it was a classic Governor Otter. And I got a speech at the time that I realized that every cabinet member got. And it was about his emphatic insistence that you can bring business principles to state government. And he preached that everywhere he went to his cabinet. And we all heard it loud and clear. So I heard that speech and I was even more energized to jump in and get going. And then I got up and he walked back to his office and I was leaving on the other side of the room and he stopped me and said, wait, he said, one more thing. He said, the way I look at it, I have one person to hire and fire and it's you. Now go to work. And that was it. And the fun thing for me is, to me, that was an example of leadership where he delegated the responsibility and then he said, I'm depending on you. Now go do it. And what I really appreciated was the rest of that, where he basically supported me in anything I needed to do. And to me, that was a sign of a true leader. And yeah, I mean, we got to some spots where we didn't agree. I'm sure he didn't appreciate my statement as I was leaving that we shouldn't lower taxes, we should invest in workforce, and that all those things are just part of politics. But the thing I always appreciate about Governor Otter was he was a pure gentleman, but he was that leader that said, I trust you and I'm going to support you and I'm going to depend on you to be successful and do your job. And I've always appreciated that.
I do want to get to, so Jeff, you've got this experience that's really unique. Now you've been,
I've on the seen inside the of, underbelly of the,
you've
of
seen, the, you've seen the giant, underbelly yeah. of the, you've seen how the, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm in, and then you've got all this pre-government experience and now you're out.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your company now, because I think that'd be very interesting.
Oh, I appreciate
to,
that.
To our listeners.
Yeah, no, it's been a lot of fun. So as I sat there at the front row of the economy for 4 years, I had one little tidbit in the back of my mind that a seed someone had planted early on when we'd had a debate about what Idaho's economy really needed. And I went down the path of helping startups and you know, getting early stage funding and those kinds of things. And I don't want to discount that because that's really important. But there's a lot of smart people doing that. But this gentleman stopped me, said, no, he said, actually, I would challenge you to pay attention to our mid-market companies. And I thought, okay, that's really interesting. He said, I would propose to you that the biggest lift Idaho's economy could have is finding a way to help our mid-market companies be successful. And mid-markets, you know, in this region is 10 million to 100 million. That's kind of the zone for Idaho's mid-market companies. So that was always in the back of my mind. And everywhere I went, I saw examples of really good companies run by good people that were often bumping against a glass ceiling because they just didn't have the talent or the capabilities or even the capacity to break through to the next level. So that was in the back of my mind. And then at the same time, I saw all of this high-end talent, particularly here in the Treasure Valley, people that in some cases had international resumes who just chosen to live here, didn't need or want a full-time job, but they're just kind of hanging out. And I thought, wait a second, there's got to be a way to bring those two together. So what we did, to answer your question, Tommy, is we formed a team. We've called it Rectify Partners. A lot of people tease me about the name, but my point is we can help transform companies. But we have organized a group of people that are essentially a portal where we're activating a lot of this high-end talent that's dormant, and we're organizing it in a way that's available on demand for mid-market companies to access on an affordable basis. And so that's what we're doing. And
so turnarounds.
Well, you know, so we tinkered with the idea for about 3 years and we finally rolled it out officially at the beginning of last year. So we've been in the market for 1 year. And I tell people that we threw out the idea and then we went into hyper listening mode. You know, that old adage of listening to your customers. We've been listening very carefully to what the market wanted. And it's been interesting. People have encouraged us. A lot of folks have sent us into turnaround. So we have the talent and the horsepower to go in and fix a company. So we love those situations. A lot of people have encouraged us to bring our teams forward and make it available for companies who are going through succession planning, who don't have a transition plan or who need to kind of prepare their companies to sell. So that's an area that we're working in. But at the end of the day, the thing that we're having the most fun is going in and helping companies scale. It goes back to your original question about what businesses need to be successful. A lot of times it takes a lot of work to put the infrastructure and the processes and the systems and the organizational structure, all those things in place so a company or a team can really scale to the next level. We're doing a lot of that as well. So at the end of the day, we talk to people about how we can bring horsepower and capacity to an existing management team. We integrate our team in and around that company for as long as they want us, and we help them get to the next level. And then we peel away when they don't need us any longer. Love. And we're having a ball. We're seeing some fun projects. We're working with some great people. And it just, it reignites my enthusiasm for this region and this economy. There's some great businesses here. And so we've simply activated all this high-end talent and made it available for people to access so they can get to the next level.
You know, Jeff, this is one thing that I'm sure Tommy will get a chuckle out of. You know, we have this incredible magnet of people coming here. You know, we've got Chobani, we've got Cliff Bar, the Magic Valley Miracle, you're very familiar with.
Yeah, very familiar with it.
And now Amazon possibly coming to Nampa.
Yeah.
And yet the strain on the infrastructure. So what comes first, the chicken or the egg?
There we go.
Oh, you want to open up that can of worms?
Let's open it up.
All right. Let's go there. You know, it is a chicken and egg, especially when you're not ready for the growth. And so one of my biggest fears, going back to my earlier comment about some of my fears for the future is, you know, that point I made earlier, the talent and capital. Capital is one of the quiet issues we have in our economy that I think we need to talk more about, and we need to talk more about it quickly. We can't expect to grow and not pay for some infrastructure, right? I mean, just, I think if people are out there thinking that we're going to somehow accommodate and absorb all this growth without making some kind of investment, we're truly deluding ourselves. So with that, fundamental principle, laid down, one of our biggest challenges in Idaho is we have put up barriers to capital. And instead of embracing capital and creating avenues for capital to come into our state, we've actually put up barriers when it comes to funding infrastructure. And there's another story I can tell, but I had a chance to go down with a delegation of legislators to Utah. And it was Senator Winder, actually, that took us down there. And I credit him for having just the foresight to go down and ask the question. And they'd entertained us with all of their leaders in the state that had sat behind in the closed door sessions where they rolled up their sleeves and had the knockdown, drag out arguments over what their policy should be. And they were all there in the room. Their pro tem of the Senate was there. And they had some real, they accommodated us at a high level. And we had a chance to spend a day with them just listening to the war stories about what it took for them to figure out how to set their policy. And it was fascinating. And in that conversation, Zions Bank gave a presentation. And this, one of those moments that kind of stopped me in my tracks. They compared, it was probably 2015 when we were there. They did a study and they analyzed Utah versus Idaho. And they showed us in that year they looked at, Idaho had brought in about $230 million for infrastructure funding. So that's schools, sewer districts, water districts, they'd calculated the amount the capital would come into Idaho. That same year, Utah brought in $2 billion.
Well, bigger state though, bigger population.
It's the tools. And I asked people to stop for a second, think about that. Was 1 year's difference in capital. So here's the key. And so then they started walking us through the differences. And this is where it gets controversial. And this is why I encourage people.
What was the source of that? Impact fees? Tommy's all about the impact
fees. Yeah, I'm sure he loves
you. You got to remember, Kevin is Clint Eastwood from Gran Torino. Stay off my lawn. Pay your way, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think Kevin's point is a good point. We have, you look at our fee structure and, you look at ACHD fees, for an example.
Yeah, no, they're
high.
They're really
high. They're as high as anywhere we develop. Yeah. So I think you kind of pay your own way there. I think you're going to get into, there's got to be mechanisms or tools in the tool chest to fund infrastructure, whether that's public transportation. Yeah. And I know where you're heading, so I agree with you. But if you look at just even the bonding mechanisms we have for bonding revenue sources that are consistent off of utilities, even.
Yeah. I mean,
the we just don't have the tools they have. So Kevin, one example that I tell people is in most jurisdictions, if you have a sewer company for a city, and you have revenue coming in off those people, you can easily bond existing revenue to improve your sewer.
Yes, exactly.
In Idaho, you can't do that. So there's some of this where you get people that are hyper concerned about, hey, I don't want my taxes to go up, but I want to be able to vote every single my tax vote. Take that off the table. Just look at how you finance things. And the example I always used is if we do a building like the one we're sitting in today, we will finance it different than if we build a building for a dentist down the street. Yeah. We will use different tools for financing. We'll put in different amounts of cash. We'll plan differently.
But the key is having the tools.
The key is having the tools. There's not one size fits all for commercial development. Or think of your own household or how you finance education or, you know, a business, a small business. You know, there's a small business loan. There's this, that, and the other. But you get to the state government and you look around us at conservative states and say, what are the tools they have available so that they use them appropriately?
That's so well said.
And the problem, if you don't have the appropriate tools, you misuse the tools you have. So urban renewal, there's another bill coming up right now.
Great statement.
You've got urban renewal. I'm the first to admit, especially after going around the state, there are some egregious misuses of that tool from around the state.
Yeah.
Stuff that you look at and you're like, there's no way they should have used money to do that.
But the only tool.
It's the only tool in the box.
Yeah.
So when it's the only tool in the box, guess what? It's going to get misused.
Yep.
So we need to have the leadership and the foresight to say, okay, what are the investment tools you would need at the state level to keep up with infrastructure?
Yeah, that's a great
and
point.
And what are the ways to appropriately use those tools? Even take urban renewal. There should not be a one-size-fits-all law. There should be urban renewal. There should be blight.
Yeah.
There should be true urban renewal and there should be tax increment financing. They're all three different. In Idaho, it's one and it leads to misuse.
Yeah,
and then it actually exacerbates the problem.
Yep.
So now you have a funding mechanism that's bonding that is being misused. Well, guess what? It rallies those people even more to say, hey, stop everything. When the problem is there's not enough tools in the beginning.
So well said.
We catch ourselves in a circle that, I don't know, I don't know your thoughts, but we sit out here, look at this highway every day. And I mean,
there's so much
to do and it's so expensive and I don't know where it's going
to
end.
But to your point, I mean, that was what was interesting about that conversation. Cause they lined up the differences between, our state and Utah. And to your point about urban renewal, they have three kinds of urban renewal. One for public buildings,
yep.
One for greenfield projects and one for blight or brownfield projects. Right. And each one has a different approach to governance and different rules. And they're all carefully and appropriately designed for each of those applications. So it gets away from what you just described. We do. We have one tool and we try to cram square pegs in a round hole. And it just causes the controversy. And then the problem is because of that, we have people in the legislature that fight it every year trying to shut it down completely. Instead of looking at pulling back and saying, wait, what tools do we appropriately need? Let's maybe even expand it.
With each tool having appropriate sideboards.
Right. And with the right kind of governance. But here's what really got me is the local option taxing, for example. That's controversial. But here's what I would say on that. So Utah, any community can implement local option taxing. Idaho, they can't. It's not even an option. And here's what I would say, you know, when you look at a company and is in their strategic preparation, if they know they're going to hit a growth curve or they're trying to grow, one of the first things you do is you organize your teams and your process and your systems to push decision-making as far out to the front lines as possible. So you want people who are interacting with customers, seeing the issues firsthand in the field, you want those people making the decisions. So as a company, you develop your governance and your authority and your decision-making processes so those people in the front lines have the ability to make those choices. And then you go to work on giving them the tools, right? That, you know, classic term is decentralized decision-making. That's just standard business protocols. But if you pull back and look at our state in that lens or through that lens, we've aggregated all of our key decision-making into 105 people that meet once a year for 90 days. And I would propose to you that that's the worst organizational structure we could possibly have when we know we're about to be overrun with growth. To your point, Tom, we need to be pushing the decision-making authority and the tools out to the community so they can determine their own destiny. And I'll just kind of wrap this up, but the differences are our cities don't have, most of our cities can't assess any sales tax revenue sourcing. And yet you look at some of the communities that can. So in Idaho, our tourism communities can do it. Sun Valley is a great example. Haley and Ketchum, they used their local option taxing capability to extend their airport. Someone figured out if they added a few hundred feet to their airport, to their landing strip, that they could actually land bigger planes and they could get small commercial flights into Sun Valley. Well, they're a tourism town. So they're going to live and die off of people coming to town. So they raised some money using a local option assessment to extend their runway. And lo and behold, as soon as they got that, they had brand new hotels pop up in town. And now that place has more and more tourism. That's how people can use a source of capital. But back to your point about tools, so revenue bonds. So those are the bonds that are supplied off of water districts, sewer districts. You mentioned this earlier, Tommy. What's interesting about those is they become the collateral for a bond or a loan. So those creditors can't pierce that and that veil and go to the general assets of a municipality. So the only collateral they have are the revenues from that district. In Idaho, it takes a 51% voter approval to implement one of those bonds. In Utah, it's a majority vote of county commissioners.
Yeah.
That's the difference. And then you get to the granddaddy of all, and you talk about our 66 2/3 approval requirements for school bonds. And some, those are the bonds that can attach to the general assets of a municipality. Those are the ones that are higher risk, and they should have maybe a higher threshold. But there's only two states in the nation that have a 66 2/3 requirement, us and Kentucky. Now, I'm sure that there's good people in Kentucky, but when you think about it, if there's 48 other states that have figured out that that maybe not be the best approach, we probably ought to be paying attention to that. And those are the kinds of things that we've done that have just simply raised barriers to capital. And we've left our company, our community stranded. But here's one last data point, and then I'll be quiet.
I was just going to say go Wildcats, but go ahead, Jeff.
No, but, so here's what was fascinating to me is in that day we learned all this stuff. Zions turned around and they made a statement that really stopped me in my tracks. They pointed out that there's not one AAA rated municipality in Idaho. And I didn't believe them, so I went and looked. And it was mind-blowing to me because we wrap ourselves in this flag of being conservative and kind of this pay-as-you-go, like you're talking about, and yet we're strangling our economies from having the capital they need to thrive. And I've asked around and I've talked to some communities about, I've asked them about that AAA rating issue, and they said, oh, yeah. In fact, there's about 5 or 6 communities in the state that if they had the ability to bond more frequently and demonstrate to the capital markets that they can use capital judiciously, they would actually have a AAA rating. And the irony of that is if they had a AAA rating, their cost of money would come down, their terms would be more flexible, and they'd actually be able to lower their cost of borrowing. So those are some of the ironies. You hear, I get pretty animated about this, but
sure.
I sit and look at the fact that we've raised these walls to capital at a time when our state is desperately going to need capital to thrive. And that's the only way we're going to be able to absorb this growth in an intelligent way. And other than that, I don't have any strong feelings on
topic. Thank you. Time goes by way too fast. We greatly appreciate you being here today.
Well,
I think Kevin's got one more question for you.
One more quick question. What inspires you, Jeff, personally?
Two things, to make things better and to win.
Thank you, Jeff.
It's an honor. Thank you for the opportunity. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you to everybody for listening. You're listening to the Inspire Excellence Podcast.
You've been listening to the Inspire Excellence Podcast. We invite you to find something that inspires you this week. Join us again for our next episode.